Welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, a career prosecutor from Savannah, Georgia. With the next three episodes, I will be talking to fellow podcaster and truly exceptional investigator, That Leo Guy, regarding gangs and prosecution. If you've not listened to his podcast yet, it is an incredible resource for every aspect of law enforcement and is well worth your time. We sat down to talk about gangs, specifically the vice lords out of Chicago. But as you'll hear in the episodes that follow, we talk at length about the obstacles to investigations, prosecutions, and the societal problems that allow gangs and their cycle of violence to continue. Listen in. And welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. We have the mashup you've been waiting for. I know all of the listeners have been waiting for the mashup between Inside the Bar and That Leo Guy. And I am so grateful to have That Leo Guy on. Say hello to our listeners, please.
Hello. Thank you for having me, Christy. How's it going?
Oh, it's going great. I've been listening to your podcast, and it's been really educational. I've learned a lot. And I really am grateful that you were willing to come on and talk to me. I wanted to pick your brain, something that had come up when we had been talking separately, is gang investigations.
Yeah.
You have a ton of experience. And can you give a little bit of your background so that it makes some sense to listeners?
Back in 2009, I started working at a jail, and there was gang activity there. It was a regional jail up in Virginia. And it was kind of weird. The grouping of people, they tended to put same gang members together in the pods, which I guess makes sense. But I also had some issues there when, like, I'd try to lock a guy down, put him in a cell for some kind of violation. He threw his chicken marinara across the room or something. And three other guys would go, and he'd be refusing to lock down. And three other guys would go, "He's blood. We're not locking down." So they would stand together. Everybody else in the pod locks down, and they would stand together. So that was kind of my surface level introduction to the gang world. It wasn't investigations, but it was an introduction to their loyalty to each other.
Well, and that's such a great, I mean, I could go on and on from an investigation standpoint, like just the knowledge that you gain from people who are jailers or prison guards, or, you know, there is so much information those people have on the ground that never gets shared with anybody else, or very rarely does, but it's such useful stuff to just know how things operate and how they operate on the inside versus the outside. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So tell me some more.
Yeah. And there's, what you're saying is spot on. And some jails and prisons have really good intel units and some do not. And it is a cold, hard fact that there's significant contraband in the jail and prison systems. It gets in by drones. It gets in by guards. Any way you can think of, I'll say what I got to say, probably gets in by lawyers at times.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
It gets in. And there are phones, there are knives, I know of a gun being found in a prison up here. So there's a lot going on. And there are hits that are ordered from the street due to whatever crap they got going on out there, whether they think somebody's telling or some slight or some disrespect. And they order hits, and those hits are executed more frequently than people might realize. Whether the person is just stabbed multiple times and fights his way out or is killed, it happens all the time. So significant links between that and people carrying rank in jail or prison versus their rank on the street and how that changes. So I'm getting ahead of myself now. So worked in the jail for a bit, hated it. I felt like I was in jail. So I started applying for police jobs in the South. I ended up getting hired in Savannah, Georgia, and going down there and policing for almost 10 years. During that time, on patrol, there were gangs. My area that I worked on the west side of Savannah, Carver Village, the Augusta Avenue area, Cloverdale, up and down 17. Not I wouldn't call them bad neighborhoods, but there was gang activity. There was spray paint. There were groups of young men that would claim gang membership. And then I went from there.
I know I'm interrupting, but from a Savannah perspective, and this has come up in other episodes of my show, it seems like we have you know, some national gang activity, but it seems more homegrown here. And I'm sure you're going to be able to speak to that, but it is a little bit different from the bigger structures that you see. So you went from here, from Savannah, out into the world.
Yeah. Out onto different things. To address what you said, who's the mayor? Mayor Johnson. Some of these folks may not love me saying this. Savannah has a gang issue, and it did when I was there. And gang issues tend to grow, not shrink, over time, and reach greater levels of organization and recruitment and violence. And there are active gangs in Savannah. You're correct that it's more neighborhood driven. It fluctuated. It seemed like year to year. Carver Village had CVT. Kyler Brownsville had CBV, which was like Kyler Brownville. And then when I was there, 9BG popped up. That was the 90s baby gangsters. They were doing a bunch of stuff for a while. I've run into Bloods. I didn't meet a lot of Crips there. I remember some Blood doing like a triple murder on the east side. But correct in that I didn't meet a lot of guys there that were traveling to California to meet the big homies. Whereas at these bigger cities, they're traveling to home base. They're getting sanctioned by the organization itself, as opposed to a group of guys who kind of creates it. Maybe one of them kind of knows somebody, but it's different than the members are expected to travel to Watts or wherever and, you know, meet some guys. That's a different level of dedication than I saw. Not downplaying it. It's just different. And to me, sometimes the neighborhood groups can be a little more volatile because the organization sucks and they don't really answer to anybody. They're young, they're undisciplined, and they might be more likely to shoot somebody than the guy who has been taught to keep peace unless you're forced to have war, like some of these groups that I'm familiar with.
Yeah, it is fascinating. Of course, that got my mind going on a tangent that I don't want to interrupt the flow with, but at some point we might discuss. So you go out into the world,
mm-hmm.
and where did you go from Savannah? What did you end up doing work-wise?
I went to a couple different federal agencies. And I also dealt with gangs some when I was on the Marshall Fugitive Task Force. I was a police officer, but I was assigned to them. Some of those guys are gang members, so got a little bit familiar. Fugitive hunting's not just kicking in doors. You have to gather intel. So it's talking to girlfriends, baby mamas, moms, moms, convincing moms that it's better to turn their 22-year-old gangbanger son over to me than have him get stopped on a traffic stop and try to blast his way out. Convincing mom that I don't want to shoot out and I will bring overwhelming force to where he surrenders and I'll communicate just like this with him, as opposed to some patrol cop when he feels like he can get away with it and gets in a firefight. So I ended up getting some insight into the gang world through getting to know gang members, close friends and family. So I left there. I got hired by HSI briefly. Didn't do any gang stuff there. They do it. They do a lot of this cartel stuff. I was there so brief. I was assigned to a child pornography group. Probably didn't help me stay, didn't help my retention.
Yeah, I don't think that would be very much fun.
Yeah, then I left that. I don't really want to go into the next agency that I spent my most time at, but I went and ended up working a lot of gangs and violent crime up in Memphis, Tennessee.
Wow. Okay. And you sit here and you think about, like, just what you know of me. Generic person who does not live in Memphis. You don't really think of Memphis as being a hotbed of gangs, but when you're way outside of it. But it has over the years, you start to hear more and more about the violence that's been happening in Memphis. Is a lot of that gang related or not?
97%. Yeah.
Wow. Whoa. That is a
Oh,
huge percentage.
totally pervasive gang culture. Being in a gang is totally normal here. People are much more open about it, whereas in Savannah, gang was a four-letter word. Here, it's normal. If I say who you with, they'll say, "Oh, I'm grape," meaning a Grape Street Crip. It rolls off the tongue. It's nothing. So it's much more normalized here. It's not stigmatized at all.
That's wild.
Kids tw 12 to 14, it's very normal to slide into that lifestyle.
Well, I mean, if it's everywhere, that's what you think you're supposed to do.
Yeah,
So,
once you hit high school, there is gang activity in every school and every high school in Memphis, probably most middle schools.
wow. So, are you talking? We've already acknowledge there's this kind of divide. It's probably not very clear cut, but this kind of divide between your homegrown gang, your neighborhood gang, and these more structured national gangs. From what you have seen, where you are, is it more one than the other?
It's a mix. I'll go through some Memphis gangs and I'll go through the organized ones first that I've seen most commonly, and then go into some of the, I don't want to call them less organized, but homegrown, grassroots, we'll call them. So obviously, we think of Bloods and Crips. Bloods and all these gangs. Two things to think about. One, there's tons of subsets, and the subsets are all different. So you can't say the Bloods are all violent carjackers, because if you go to Chicago and you look at a small subset in Englewood, Chicago is a huge city. All the different blood sets are going to carry themselves a little differently. They fall under the same general idea, but they're not doing the same kind of crime. It's not the same culture. It's different in different places, and it's different in different sets. You could have an Avenue Piru Blood in Memphis who may be totally different than one in Phoenix, Arizona, because it's just a different culture. They may be more violent, maybe less. They may do more complex schemes. They're going to have the same general set of guidelines, but the culture is very different. So as far as Bloods, I haven't worked personally. I don't think I've worked. I've definitely charged some Bloods, but as far as like an in-depth gang case, I haven't. But there's Piru, there's Avenue Piru. So if you see guys calling each other Rue, their nicknames are Rue, a lot of time that's going to be Piru Bloods. What else is there? I don't know. I haven't really fooled with the Bloods that much.
So, but you've got Bloods, Crips, and obviously one of the things that you had brought to my attention, and I've heard obviously Latin Kings, which is also out of Chicago, but again, they've gotten Nine Trey, which my understanding was like it started in prison, if I'm right about that.
You talking about the Latin Kings?
Well, I was thinking about the Nine Trey group, but yeah. Latin Kings, my understanding is they started in Chicago, but Chicago seems to be like a hotbed of generating these kinds of gangs.
Yeah, they're like a founding father up there, I
Yeah,
guess.
really. But you had mentioned Vice Lords, which I had not really and still don't know very much about. And identifying these gangs, I'm trying to figure out like how much training do you have to distinguish one from another, because it seems like they all have different symbols, different tags, different tats, all of that stuff, different language and things they avoid, and just the little I know from the couple of Bloods cases I've touched, it seems like you already said these subsets kind of all approach them a little bit differently. How do you know what you're looking at?
So, I mean, the training center that I went to become a federal agent is in South Georgia. Yes, they go on, you get training on gangs, but with the different subsets and area stuff, you can show me all the symbols you want. plenty of companies have created these gang handbooks, and they're just not always, they're not accurate for everywhere because they can't be. They probably are for where they designed it. Most of what my learning was 98% on the street and, you know, talking to guys at the gang unit or being part of Title III wiretaps where you hear them talk and going to gang conferences and gang conferences in the area where I'm working. And different people go up and talk about the gang cases they've worked. You got the guys that go up and brag about their indictment and how they won the war on gangs. And then you got guys that actually teach you about the gang they worked and kind of do it that way. But it was mostly working it. I like talking to people. I was a human intelligence collector in the military. I like collecting intelligence from humans. And I just talk to people, and in interviews, I'll sit with a gang member for 6 hours if he's comfortable talking to me and just explore how he got there, what happened in his early life that he lost. Usually there's some story about their loss of structure or lack from the start, or how they had a structure and lost it by the loss of a parent or a grandparent, and how they ended up in that life.
That's all too common, isn't it? Especially in urban areas.
All of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess, you know, some of what I'm wondering is, how is it that you really have had some success in figuring out what is going on with the gang culture where you are? So I'm the reason I'm asking it this way is, you know, I've had a couple of gang cases. I've seen what were brought to me as gang investigations that we couldn't prove what we were looking at or hoping to be looking at. And I feel like sometimes how it is approached or how, you know, people are trying to make connections as investigators, they don't always mesh. So tell me a little bit about the process that you've seen that has been successful.
So for me, as someone that values the interview over every other technique, I want genuine cooperators. I don't want somebody cooperating because my figurative foot is on their head, because I have charges over them and they have to, and they're going to give me partials. I want somebody that is going to change their course of thought and want to be on my side, because generally these guys have been screwed over by the gang at some point, and getting them to buy in that they were sold some oceanfront property in Arizona, this gang is not what it was told to them as when they were 12 or 14. It has ruined their life. The older members who convinced them to join put them on violent missions as boys, generally boys, the occasional girl, but generally young boys. And then now you've done a couple murders and you're part of it for life, or violent robberies or whatever they were involved in. Getting them convinced that it's bullshit, and they're not there for you. They're there for themselves. They're profiting off of you. You're generally paying dues. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've told guys in most every gang, there's a rule that says you do not cooperate with police. Do not talk to police, period. And once you start getting cooperation from certain members, I'll tell the higher ranking members when I go to their house and raid it, do a search warrant and get evidence and take them to the interview room. That's who you need. A foot soldier is great, but you need at least middle management. You need somebody who's a somebody. And I'll tell them, how do you think I got here? So you're 40 years old. And do you think your fellow members are following the rules? Is there any chance I got here blind? Absolutely not. So you're going to be left holding the bag. And it's getting them to realize that they're the only one standing true, kind of isolate them from their own group. And they don't have to turn right away. I've had quite a few that call me after weeks and they go, man, what you said, man, Leo, what you said kind of hit me. I've been thinking about that.
Wow. So, and again, I think that you're absolutely right. Having a conversation with someone, making a connection with a person
Yeah.
has lasting effect. And you're right, it might not be immediate. I'm wondering, so you sit down with somebody, have a conversation. How do you know? And I'm guessing that you're just really good at picking up on verbal and nonverbal cues, but which is a little unfair because not all of us are like that. But when you're sitting down with somebody in an investigation, do you know going in that they're a potential gang member? Is it something that you figure out as the conversation proceeds? Tell me how do you identify that?
Good question. The answer is it depends. Everybody loves that answer. It depends.
My favorite.
Depends on the type of investigation. So if I'm working a gang case, which was a big portion of the last 7 or so years of my life, then yes, you know they're in the gang. If you don't know, like you said, it's going to depend a lot on cues. Hopefully, you've done your homework. You've been able to do your homework on the front end, be that getting a consent or a search warrant on their phone, their social media, and knowing the gang that you think they may be part of well enough that when you see them, making all their B's into C's, you're like, okay, this is probably a Crip. Like he's not writing the letter B. Things like that. If you know there are gang members, obviously some people won't admit it. They think they're going to get in more trouble. They're standing on the rules of the gang. I mean, we call it in the interview world rapport development. I can sit in that phase of the interview for the first 5 hours if the last 5 minutes is fruitful. I can sit there and talk. And the way to do it for that works for me. There's people that I've interviewed with that do it totally differently than I do. But what works for me and what I've seen work for most people, even with different interview techniques, is a seeking a genuine understanding and having a genuine interest in how you became a 14 or a 30 or a 50-year-old shooter or able to call murders. I actually want to know. And once you're not genuine, these guys, if they're raised by the streets, they have to trust their instinct and their gut because that's all they have. That's what it's probably saved their life multiple times. They've been at a drug deal there to buy a pound of meth to go sell, a pound of weed, whatever, and they saw somebody move in a way they didn't like. They saw eyes dart, and they chose action and it saved them, or they didn't choose action and they got shot. So they are watching the interviewer to see if you're genuine. And if you're not, they're probably a better poker player than most of these dudes in Vegas because they can read it. They've been reading it since they were 12, trying to find food, trying to sell drugs, trying to escape the police. So what it comes down to me is being genuine, being real, caring, not judging, wanting to know about their childhood. These dudes will open up about the stuff they went through. So as far as how to identify them, it's usually just a conversation just like this. And it's not a barrage of questions. If they clearly don't want to answer questions, you got to stay in the rapport phase. You can't be a spammer where you just keep hitting send and you're getting nothing back. Like, picture the people that you've texted with that send you like seven texts. It's annoying, right? It's the same
Right.
thing when cops do it and they're like, come on, I know you're in the gang. You know you're in the gang. Come on. So
Yeah.
it's shifting gears.
It's an interesting thought process, and I'm thinking, part of what you're describing, some of the language that you're using, it's interesting to me that there are parallels between, your 12-year-old that's growing up on the streets in this violent environment, and the military experience that you've talked about in your show, And also some of the corporate language that you're talking about, you got middle management, and there's a lot of truth to that. There's a lot of parallel to it. And because I have had been in Savannah, in a place that wants to deny that there are real gang problems, I think that that can get hidden really easily. Like the fact that this is a criminal enterprise as opposed to just a we're just people who get together and like do church stuff or whatever. I think that there's always an excuse or a way to hide it. And I wonder if you can speak to that a little bit based on what you've seen.
Quite a bit of the recruitment is based in things like that. It's like I said, it's oceanfront property in Arizona. It's selling a child, often 11 to 14, sometimes younger, but 11 to 14 is where they tend to grab them up from what I've seen. And the younger kids may hang around, but they're not a member. And they tell them they're doing community service. They'll see these guys out giving out turkeys. I mean, around Thanksgiving, picking up trash. They do some of that. Some of these gangs absolutely do that. They might protect an old lady on the street. You know, if something's going on, they may step in. It's almost like a little police department for the area that doesn't really have rules. And so that's very enticing to a boy. I'm not even going to call him a young man. Like if you're 12, you're not a young man. A boy with no structure, usually no parents, and I'll include that as father is absent, prison, dead, or not there. Mother is either not there because she's on drugs, locked up herself, so grandma's raising the kid, or just doesn't care. Like didn't want to have kids, had some unprotected sex, had some babies, and isn't raising these young boys. And
Well,
so,
there's one other factor there with the moms. I've also seen the ones that are working like four jobs because they have 14 kids, and they just
correct.
can't do it any other
Or have shit, have two kids
way.
and doing it alone. I mean,
Yeah.
it's really hard. And
It is
you're
hard.
and
I mean,
the streets step in.
yeah, they do.
It's hard with two involved parents. It's hard logistically. So, you know, one with who either dropped out of high school or got a GED and is making low wages, you're going to be working a lot if you're not committing crime. And you end up stuck and your kids may step out. So, I'm not trying to put all the blame on the parents. There's definitely people that want to be good parents and want to be good to the kids. But a lot of it is if they had structure at home, they wouldn't have fallen into this life. And these groups, they prey on that. And they show the kids structure. They show them, I mean, imagine being 12, your dad's dead. He was in a gang, he's dead. Mom is on drugs and prostituting and gone all the time, random dudes coming over all the time. And does not care at all what you do and does not watch you. And you're 12. Those kids kind of don't have a chance. It's unlikely they're going to be like, oh, I got to get up and catch the bus. Like, who among us would have done that? There's no food in the house. They have all these problems. You wake up hungry, you're unsafe, there's gunshots at night. It's just they got too much going on. They have no safe place. And then they meet somebody who might be 40 years old and 250 pounds and healthy. He's eating. He's always got a gun on him with an extended mag. He's got tattoos on his face. He talks a smooth talk, or he doesn't talk much, but he's cool. He's probably got a nice car. The girls like him. All the stuff a little boy looks up to, especially when you haven't had, when you're raised in poverty. You tend to put extra value on these things. And they look up to these guys. And then you go to a meeting, and there's 30 of these guys. They're all well fed. They all have guns. They speak to each other respectfully. And they don't interrupt when the boss is talking. They put somebody in violation when they lie, when they steal. And I mean, anybody that's coached sports knows boys crave structure. And they fight it sometimes. And then there's a violation. There's a consequence. And in sports, you run laps. In gangs, you might get beat up. You might get shot by your own members. You might have to pay money. But they give them what they need and draw them in. And it's a family to a lot of them.
So structure, rules, consequences, all the things that as a society, what we put out there is that is what we think families do. But when there's no family structure, something else has to step in or not. And so that it is definitely an option. I think that that's part of the reason, like, and I would imagine you've probably had this situation. I know that I have, where you sit down with someone who's charged as being a gang member, or they've been a victim of something involving gang stuff, and their parent does not want to admit that there is a gang involved. They see it as, oh, these other kids are good kids who help take care of my child, or you know, these adults are, you know, making sure my child goes to church or whatever.
Yeah, this is all I got.
Right. They're just, and my favorite, it's just a rap group. You know, so when you see that, how do you speak to that? Like, are you able to convince people, or do you just let them go on believing whatever they want to believe and go, you know, just gather the information?
You mean let them go on believing that it's a good thing?
Yes.
So you can't rip somebody's belief structure out from under them like a rug, because they're just not going to go with you. They're not going to collapse. They're just going to be like, oh, this is just another cop that says gang members are bad. They put some of these guys, they call a family. We're not a gang. We're a family, or we're just a group, especially these neighborhood gangs. It's no, we just hang out. We just happen to wear the same colors, throw up the same signs, carry guns, do robberies, whatever, but we're a family. So I don't attack it. That's why I said I extend the rapport building phase, the conversational phase, because they need to know me a little bit. Because at the beginning of the day, I'm sitting on the opposite side of the table from them. Not literally, I try to be next to them, but figuratively, they are starting the conversation uncomfortable, whether it's at a police station or in my unmarked police car or at my discreet office. They're not where they want to be. And I don't look like them, talk like them. I'm not from their neighborhood. I'm not one of their people. So if I try to just say, gangs are bad, cops are good, I'm trying to catch the criminals, a baby got shot, help me. It's not realistic. I need to change their thinking by establishing, I keep using the word, by establishing a rapport. And it's just what I said before. I'm going to listen much more than I talk. If they're willing to talk, I'm going to listen. And if they stop talking and they look like they have more to say, I can just sit there in silence and wait. And they'll fill it.
That's probably something that's pretty rare in that environment, is someone actually listening. So I can imagine that for 11-year-old kids, I'm thinking my own poor children, you know, who had to get lectures from me.
Mm-hmm.
Something goes wrong and I'm going to start talking as opposed to necessarily listening. So that's just from an investigative standpoint, it's a really interesting way to make someone talk to you, because again, I've seen a lot of really good interviews. It having that 5-6 hours can be really rough, though. I mean, you know, you're in the middle of an investigation. Sometimes you just don't have the time to do rapport building that you're talking about. Is there a way to allow for that or have some give in there, or is that just like because in the federal system, things can take longer, so you have more time? I'm trying to figure out like how to advise somebody that this is something that can actually happen.
No, I mean, I've been in situations where we don't have a lot of time. You know, we bust somebody, another car just fled. Something is, there's supposed to be some impending situation that we need information. In those, I tend to be more direct, still understanding, but clearly and calmly. It depends a lot on the person. If they're more emotional, I mean, we're going way into the interviewing rabbit hole, but I love interviewing, so I'll make your listeners' ears bleed.
That's okay.
If most people, there's, I mean, we've all seen the DISC assessments. There's all different kinds of people, and to break it way down, much more simple than it is, there's emotional people and logical, rational people, and nobody's all of one or the other, but we tend to lean one way or the other. I've been accused of being less emotional than I need to be and rationalizing everything. So if somebody was interviewing me, they would want to appeal to my rational side. It might look something, but I also am a family man. That's my emotional side. That if you're interviewing me, that would be the path is, hey, we've been watching you for weeks. We know you care about your family. You know this guy that just fled the stop. We need to catch him right now. You need to understand how this decision affects the next 10 to 20 years of your life. So here's what we have on you. And if you love your kids and you want to see them graduate high school, I would love to have information on who that guy is that just fled and shot at us as he left. If you don't want to do that, you can make your choice and live with it. I'm not here to beat you up and shine a light in your face. On the other hand, if somebody's more emotional, same situation, I'm going to appeal to that side. And I had one not too long ago where the guy had been shooting. He had three baby mamas, three kids that were all the same age by three different women. So he'd been into it with one of them, and he kept shooting at her. And so I knew that was going to be a hot topic for him. Obviously, he's very emotional. He shoots on a whim. That's an emotional dude. These weren't calculated shootings. He shot at her on Valentine's Day over some dust up. Like, he was just into it. And then he shot at the neighbor for calling the cops. The dude was always into it. So when I talked to him, I casually brought her up, and he got very emotional and started ranting about her. And I was able to get him over to the emotional side of his brain. He started fast talking, and people don't think when they're fast talking. So, very long answer to a simple question of how do you shorten it if you don't have that kind of time? Again, it depends.
Okay.
You got to play to the person. If you have a blanket interview style of, well, this is how I do it, I would say you're a shit interviewer because it's, and I'm not putting myself above that as someone who values family and is logical. My natural inclination is to have that be my method of attack, so to speak, of how to attack the interview. And I've listened to interviews. One stands out where I kept talking to the guy about his family. We had gotten a bunch of stuff off him. He was going to get some years. And I kept bringing up family. He didn't give a shit about family. He was a dominant personality type. He cared about power. And I listened to it and I was like, I did this wrong. I needed to address the fact that his incarceration would take his power. I should have brought up that this is federal, so you might be far away. There might be none of your gang in your prison. You'll have no clout.
Yeah.
So,
I'm trying, and it's fascinating to think about like what will get somebody, what the psychology of it, obviously. I think it's just huge to, and I think so much of that is the breadth of your experience. You bring a lot to it and a lot from, all different backgrounds. The military part of it, I think, is important too, though. Like that ability to understand that some of these kids are like at that most basic, I don't know where my next meal is coming from. You could be violent with me, or I could get back out on the street and one of my gang members is gonna, discipline me for talking to you. So that animal kind of Instinct. That's got to be something that you've picked up on in your own experience. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, I'm thinking to myself, like, a lot of the guys that I've worked with have military experience. Some of them don't. I mean, I know guest of the show, Rob Santoro, doesn't have military background, although he has extensive law enforcement background in his family and everything else. Is that something that can be learned from an interview standpoint? Like that you can pick up on the fact that this kid is just at that very basic animal level,
Yeah, I don't know if it's more from military background. I don't know if I can say like, yeah, being in the Marine Corps helped me to see that. But there is a clear with most of these violent young men, I'm not going to pretend to know science or psychology better than I do. I don't know if it's sympathetic or parasympathetic, but whatever that nervous system is where they are in fight, flight, or freeze, they spend, I mean, even military. You do a 7 or 12 month deployment to a combat zone, you come back, you are in a decompression phase, you do some training as a group. They try. Now imagine being in that from the day you're born, survival mode, until 10, when you meet this senior gang member who wants you. They don't have the option to leave fight, flight, freeze. It really does a lot of damage to these people, and they need heavy counseling. I mean, at sentencings, I mean, you've seen sentencing where the defense attorneys talk about their childhood and what they've been through, and I mean, I've said it a million times. Most of us, me or you, if we were raised like that, we'd been in a gang. We'd have been doing something wild.
Right. And I think that, and I just want to throw this out there. I've watched a closing argument, defense closing argument in a blood trial that we had down here. Like the discussion, the argument to the jury was that it is the fault of the criminal justice system that gangs exist, that we have created this by sending people to prison. There's the, and it plays a little bit with some segments of the public that don't really that have never seen what gangs actually do, right? And so it is very hard to combat the media narrative. And I think that I've been coming at that this discussion from that perspective because obviously it's always the job of the attorney to translate or communicate that, yes, this is actually a criminal issue as opposed to some sort of Hollywood thing or something that we've created.
That sounds like a pretty wild, insane stretch. I mean, you can't shoot people, you can't carjack people. Like, the justice system is imperfect, clearly,
Right.
but it also, you can't let that go on. To me, it's 90% a home issue. Most of these gang members wouldn't have been in a gang if there were boundaries set, if there were consequences. That can be a whole other episode on the problems of juvenile justice, where
Well,
kids
yeah.
are getting caught for five violent carjackings before 18. They probably shot a couple people. You and I have both seen this firsthand. They turn 18 and they kill. So they had no consequences,
Right.
real consequences. I had one where I did a search warrant. This is when I was in narcotics in Savannah. I did a search warrant on a house in Kyler Brownsville, and the guy was 18. He had like seven guns, several of them, the serial numbers were obliterated. They were scratched off. He had like a couple pounds of weed, like half pound of ecstasy, various drugs. I think he had some cocaine, whatever. So it ended up being charged federally. He had like a ton of juvenile convictions for like guns at school, shooting people. So there's no, and then I'll get out of this rabbit hole, I hope. There's no consequence in the juvenile justice system. And then they hit 18 and shoot somebody and they die and you're in prison for life. And it's the same thing as if you're raising a kid and there's no consequences. And then when they're 10, you slap them as hard as you can across the face. Like,
Right.
that
Right.
doesn't make sense, but it's there should have been boundaries set and enforced from 0 to 9, right?
I have so many opinions about the juvenile justice system. I really could spend a lot of time talking about that. Maybe that will be a whole other series.
Yeah.
But I want to get back to like just gangs, because
Okay,
this was
sorry.
supposed to be not your fault. I started this. I want to get back to like these gangs and what you've seen. And I think you had sent me, like I said, some information about the Vice Lords. Again, it's
Yeah.
an education for me. This is a gang that is kind of Midwest, so we really haven't seen Vice Lords in Savannah at all. Can you talk to me about them and how they might be different from, say, a Bloods or a Crips or things I've seen before?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have such a gross amount of information in my head about that group, about the Vice Lords. It's going to be hard. I should have taken some notes. I thought about it, and then I was like, I'll probably just end up reading the notes to you guys. It'll be boring. So I may be a little bit all over the place, but bear with me. They are Chicago-based, as you said earlier. Started in a group home in Chicago, I think in the 60s, might have been earlier than that, like a troubled children's group home.
Right, it was like 1958, and I was thinking to myself, because I'm like I said, I read some material that's out there, and I was shocked that this goes that far back. I mean, I just, wow. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, totally fine. It's your show. So they are very organized. Leadership is still in Chicago. They call them Queen and King are the leaders. They have princes, based out of the Chicago area. Then the different regions have chiefs. So the Vice Lords mostly shoot down the middle of the country. Illinois, obviously Chicago, Indiana, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas. I don't know where else. That's where I've dealt with them. I bet they're in St. Louis because St. Louis and Chicago and Memphis are just geographically close. And the criminals I've met from St. Louis, similar mindset to the Chicago and Memphis guys. So I'm sure they're up there as well. Lots of subsets of the Vice Lords, kind of like Bloods and Crips. I mean, Crips, you hear about them more, rolling 60s, rolling 90s, Kitchen Crips, Grape Street Crips. They got a bunch of different subsets. Vice Lords, I'll go through a few of them. Conservative Vice Lords, they call them CVL, or Concrete Cartel. Conservative being because they follow the rules. It's not how they vote, it's they follow the rules of the organization.
I'm not surprised.
Traveling Vice Lords or TVL, they call them T Block. I don't know where traveling came from aside from the obvious. Unknown Vice Lords, they call them Ghost Mob. They want to be unseen, unheard, but they're still there, living their life, doing their thing. Renegade Vice Lords, Imperial Insane Vice Lords, and on. There's a bunch. That's RVL, blah, 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 et cetera. Those are the acronyms. I'll tell you a story real quick. I was investigating something. They'd been having all these shootouts in these apartments in Memphis called the Pepper Tree Apartments. If you want to watch kind of a funny video, there's a rapper who lives in Atlanta named Duke Deuce, and he's a gangster disciple. He's GD, and he was in the Pepper Tree on Facebook or Instagram Live. He had all his GD stuff on. He had like the star earring and the necklace. He's on live and he's on there going, "What's up, Pepper Tree? I'm out here. Come fuck with me." And then it's just a wave of gunfire. It's all traveling Vice Lords in there. It's TVL Apartments owned. And it's just this wave of gunfire. And he ducks. And I think he shot back, whatever. Lived the
Whoa.
fight another day and took his ass back to Atlanta. So I went in there. They'd been having these crimes. And so I think they had like 5 shootings in a week. And I was working some kind of case in there. And they had an arson. And so went in there and pretty stupid move. But it was a tactical decision, but also dumb. I grabbed one of our new guys at the agency and I said, hey, here's what I want to do. I want to go into the pepper tree with just the two of us. We kind of have two options to try to go do some interviews in there and find out what's causing all this shooting. We can go in like 50 deep. Patrol doesn't really go in the back of the apartments. They don't, it's a maze. They don't really go in there unless there are lots of police cars. So I said, look, we can go in like 50 deep and the place is going to lock down. There's going to be some foot chases. And we're probably not going to get cooperation. It's going to be all eyes on us. Or just me and you. I'm telling the new guy this. I was like, just me and you can walk through there and kind of park up by the front office and try to walk in and be discreet and see if we can find some witnesses so we can help solve these shootings and arsons and all this craziness. I was going as a gang war in there. So he was like, yeah, he'd been a SWAT guy before, before he came to us. He was like, okay. I think he didn't believe me how crazy it was. So, and I said, hey, we're probably going to get confronted by a group of like 5, 15-year-olds with AKs or something. Like, there's a good chance something happens like that. And there's balconies, like, something could escalate in there. Just like, we need vests on, we need radios, like, we need to be fucking dialed in. He's like, okay, cool. So we go in there and we're going door to door. We're trying to spot people out that, because it's not all criminals. The gang operates heavily in there. But there's lots of people that don't like it that are just living on Section 8 in there and
They
want the
have no
shooting.
choice.
Yeah, they want the shooting to stop. So we're trying to find those people. So we're in like one of the little cutouts where the door is, and this dude runs full speed by us with a ski mask on, gloves. It's like 2 in the afternoon. Ski mask on, gloves, and a gun in his hand. Sprints by. He didn't see us because we were in the little cutout. So I got on the radio. I'm like, hey, this is such and such. I'm toward the back of the pepper tree, black male, all black, ski mask, gloves, gun in hand, running into the apartments toward such and such building. There's a pause for a minute. And they said, no units available. Oh, and I told them beforehand, I said, they're probably not coming. Like, if we get in some drama, it's going to be spotty if they come back here. And he's like, all right,
Yeah.
cool. He's cool. He's like, all right, I'm in. So they said, no units available. So I'm like, told you, bro. Let's continue. We can't chase him. Like, us two aren't running
Right.
into there after
No.
this dude. We ended up walking through the hole in the fence that he had run through. Because I know there's a hole in that back corner and there's a corner store. So I walked, I did due diligence. I went to check and make sure the clerk wasn't dead.
Helpful.
Clerk hadn't seen anything. He had this huge shotgun behind the counter with a banana clip. And he was like, I didn't see anybody come through here. Whatever they did, he said, I didn't hear any shots. I was like, all right, that's all I know. So we went back to work, went back in, went up on the second floor, and we're walking the balcony. And these two teenage girls, they're probably like 13, are walking towards us. And so as they walk by, I said, hey, how y'all doing? And one of the girls just goes, T block, bitch. I was like, all right, there's the reminder where I'm at for real. And we
I'm
did
sure
end
she
up finding
felt
an
like
eyewitness
called out.
to the most recent thing. We made progress that day. Was it stupid? Probably. But that's TVL. TVL in my city is a lot of fast, loose, and dangerous and young. If there's a carjacking in South Memphis with some shots fired, two cars loaded down with guys in ski masks, good chance that's going to be TVL. They roll like that. They're doing random crimes. They also have organization. They're going to do targeted hits on rivals, things like that.
Well, okay, so I'm sure that there's like a lot more information out there, but I'm wondering just in this moment, you're talking about all these subgroups of the Vice Lords. Do they coordinate with each other, or are they rivals of each other? From a structural standpoint, how does that work if you've got all these subsets in one city?
You know what I'm going to say, right? It
It depends.
depends. So there have been shootouts between the groups. If there's not a reason to be shooting at each other, a perceived threat, a perceived slight, a perceived disrespect, they're generally at peace. The most killing I've seen are generally within the subgroups for violations or betrayals. But as far as CVL targeting TVL or RVL, the Renegade Vice Lords, targeting the Imperial Insane Vice Lords, it's not normal from what I've seen for them to be at war. Their holy book, so to speak, is called the Amalgamated Order of Lordism. When I first came across it, they call it the AOL. I had to look up the word amalgamated because I didn't go to law school like you. And
well, I mean, it sounds so corporate. You sent it to me and I was reading it. I'm like, this sounds like a corporate manifesto almost.
Yeah. And amalgamated means unified. Right. And the idea is that vice lords are together and they have different leadership chains and different groups. And even, I mean, I say, you know, CVL, conservative vice lord, like that's the bottom of the subgrouping, but it's not. They have different mobs within that. So there will be, you know, this mob, that mob, this county, these guys, you know, the guys in the city, the guys in the county, the guys in the next county over, and they'll come together for meetings. But and some of those subgroups are at odds with each other. There's disagreements about who the leadership should be. So at the end of the day, it's mostly an organization made up of very damaged, troubled young men. And they've been given leadership, which was damaged and troubled young men, and have become powerful. Truly, they hold actual power, middle-aged and older men, and sometimes women. So no matter what they say, there are infractions, there are violations, there are unsanctioned shootings and murders and robberies and drug dealing. There are profits made that without contributions to the organization being made that results in violations. But the very long answer, or I guess the short answer would be, they're supposed to be unified, but it's like any large organization, it's imperfect. Look at your police department. Tell me if that, you know, if you're a cop listening, tell me if it's, you know, everybody's supposed to be on the same team, but realistically.
Well, right. I mean, the older you get, the more you realize everything really is high school and you have all these little subgroups.
There's cliques. Yeah.
So I'm curious though, you talked about, and I, from a comparison standpoint, from what you have seen, Vice Lords as a big structural group versus Bloods as a big structural group or Crips as a big structural group, are they better unified, worse unified? Do you have an opinion?
Significantly better.
Okay. Why do you say that?
They tend to follow the chain of command. They tend to follow the rules better than the Crips and Bloods I've seen, where there's generally a group text with the leader of their tiny subgroup. So if you're a member and you have a 3-star universal elite, that's a rank, who's over you, you'll generally be on some kind of group text, whether that's a text or signal or, you know, WhatsApp or GroupMe or one of these, some form of communication within your subgroup. And if the chief of the area, or say the queen in Chicago, wants to communicate something to the lowest level members in, we'll say, Gary, Indiana, she's not reaching out to them. She's telling, it goes all the way down the chain, just like when you were at the prosecutor's office, how it would there. That chain is generally never violated because there are such strict repercussions. There's a whole enforcement team who carries out the violations. So it's understood not to do that.
So from a violation standpoint, from an enforcement of that structure standpoint, are the vice lords more stronger with the enforcement? Is that what makes them possibly more structured?
I've never personally seen another gang violate its own members so hard.
Tell me what you mean.
Beatings unconscious, regular broken bones, collapsed lung, gunshots, murders. People, I mean, there was a time when they were sending groups, the leader was sending groups of four from the enforcement team to former vice lords' houses and telling them, hey, you're with us for life. You need to be at the next meeting. And the standing rule was if they didn't say okay, you're either getting beat or you're getting shot on the spot.
So would these things come without warning? I mean, I guess the reason that I'm asking, like, I did a series that included a violation killing. You know, someone was put on the plate, this is blood. And, you know, there's an investigation, whatever, and there's always this sense that something's coming. You know, there was definitely a sense in the, you know, month or so leading up to this killing that there was something coming, even on the part of the person who's getting violated. Is it like that, or can this come from out of the blue with the vice lords?
You know what I'm going to say. It depends. So it can be a series of problems, but if you're a low level repeat problem, it's kind of like you'd have it where it's kind of like getting written up versus getting fired. Like if you're constantly getting in trouble, they're probably not going to shoot you, right? You're going to take your beating. You're going to have two black eyes. You might go to the hospital and then you're at the next meeting. You're healing up. You're smoking weed with the fellas again. But then, you know, if you go record a meeting for the police, that might come out of the blue. That hit might come out of the blue. You know, that's a major infraction that, you know, I would get fired if I recorded a federal agent meeting and gave it over to a gang, right? Possibly indicted. I don't know. But it's the same for them. They have a strict code, and generally they seem to have an understanding that their young members are going to be a problem. I think that's why the discipline code is so strong, because of their recruiting pool. It started in a group home, and that is where they recruit, is troubled children consistently still. And they show them a community service organization, and you got guys that are 30 that have done 10 shootings that are still saying, "Now we do community service." And you got to kind of get them to switch gears in their head to, "Hey, that's what they told you, but let's get you thinking a little bit. How many turkeys have you given out versus bullets fired? Like, what's the ratio of that?" So, yeah, their discipline is strong. Their rank structure is tight. They have very clear, they have a minister of literature that teaches the young new members who are illiterate the rule. He teaches them the AOL. So it's kind of that big brother mentor thing.
I was impressed, you know, some of the things that you told me about the internal discipline. It's almost shocking to me the lengths that this group would go to. And I don't know how comfortable we are talking about some of it, but it seemed like they were willing to, you know, it was almost like Hollywood-like. Like they were willing to take family members, you know, hostage and stuff like that. Is that something that you've seen with them? Is that a regular thing?
If you read the AOL, it is very clear that the organization comes before the individual, and they embody. It reminds me of the Marine Corps in a way. Is mission first, mission before troop welfare is what we were taught. And it's similar. It says that in the AOL. The mission comes before you. If another brother is in danger, it literally says this. It doesn't matter if he's right or wrong. You will support him in that battle. And so it's all about the brotherhood. They call each other brother. I forget the question.
I was just, and I was going to say, I also read in there, you are your brother's keeper. So yeah, it is a very structured mindset. But what I was thinking about more was like how willing this group is to like I said, like to harm someone's family or harm, you know, do like serious physical damage to somebody for a violation that to me sounded like a lesser than violation.
I would say without, like you said, using caution with not revealing too much, they completely embody there being no boundaries when it comes to the organization being successful.
Wow.
Yeah. When people commit to join this gang, which it's sold as all these different types of organizations, it's a street gang. They give themselves over to it completely.
Wow.
And they usually don't realize that they've been sold a lie. The lie being, you're one of us and we value you, but the organization does not value them. But again, if you're 15 and you're 130 pounds and hungry, and there's a 280 pound man with a rifle in his hand, not threatening you, but just looking like what you imagine a man to be, and there's 30 of these, you tend to believe that. And they tell you, this organization treated me well. We take care of our communities. We are here for the community.
And I think that that's how that's sold. And I think that that's how a lot of gang culture gets sold. I want to come back because we've talked a lot, and I think we've kind of given a good background to like the kind of people who are involved in gangs and how some of the gangs might compare to each other. I want to come back for a later episode, though, because I think it is worthwhile to talk about how to put a case together. Like what kinds of things to look for to put a case together and kind of compare like the federal requirements, that Vicar requirements versus, say, a state gang case. Because the requirements seem to be very different to me. So I think that it's kind of important to talk about how to do that. And I'd like to do that, give it its own time, give it some breathing space.
Great.
I really, really appreciate your knowledge.
Thanks for, if you can't tell, I like talking about it. I think it's super interesting.
It is.
And it's so many people. And I mean, I know a lot of people listen to your show, and it's to use the F word to show my exclamation point. It's fucking tragic that these people that had potential and were troubled kids got sucked in by these predators and then became predators themselves. And
it is.
Senior gang members are bad people, because you should not be corrupting these youth and putting guns in their hands and normalizing violence towards other people. It's the objectively wrong thing to do. And if you want to be a community service organization, do the fucking right thing, man, and stop steering these kids into prison and graves. It pisses me off, because when you see the bodies and when you meet all the way from the kids to the young men and see what they become, and you see it, and they're so troubled, and they try to normalize it, and they try to isolate the emotion because they spend so much time incarcerated, because they have to be, because otherwise they're just shooting people and robbing old ladies and being predators. And man, I wish there was a way to change that. And I'm sorry for ranting, but I pulled myself into the emotional side, because it's bullshit.
I'm with you. And I feel like this is something that we need to talk about. So I want to have you back soon and talk about this some more, because I think there's still so much more to be said. I am so grateful for your work, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Thank you. Sounds good.
The violence caused by gangs like the Vice Lords and preying on the community, fighting with other gangs, and fighting among themselves endangers everyone. Gangs are a threat to all of us. So how do we combat them? That Leo guy will be back in our next episode to talk about investigations under state and federal laws and how those can work. Join us. Thank you.